Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we're flashing back to our very first episode. This episode was recorded in April of 2007. I had been a guest on another Blog Talk Radio podcast around that time called The Dead Air Show, where I had discussed my predictions for that year's Oscar winners. It was during that show that Jerry Dennis called in, and we spoke for the first time, and we decided to try our hand at doing our own show on the network. I brought in one of my closest friends, Chris, and we were on our way. Returning to this premiere episode, I'm struck by several things. One, we had a lot of callers, an unusual amount of callers, something like half a dozen, all calling in to voice their support of our efforts. Also, we decided to open the show with Chris's impression of William Friedkin, who at the time we both had this image of him being very self-aggrandizing and pretentious. Little did we know that years later Mr. Friedkin would appear on our show, and he'd be one of the most gracious and polite guests we've ever had, giving us more than an hour of his time. Also during the show, we discuss the announcement that director Rod Laurie was remaking Straw Dogs. It would be years before his version of Straw Dogs would actually reach the screen. By that time, Mr. Laurie would have been a guest on our show twice. It's been a terrific ride these past 6 years, and this is where it all began.
Hello, William Friedkin here, the director of such classics as The Exorcist, French Connection, Jade, The Sorcerer. I was going to call it The Sorcerer, but we ended up going with just Sorcerer. These are all my films. Of course, I was there for the inception of many, many others. Wedding Crashers, for instance. Jurassic Park was basically my idea and somewhat inspired by a true story that happened to me. But I'm not here to talk about myself. I certainly can. I also invented many other things. The light bulb, the gas grill. I invented streets. No one was driving on gravel, before I came up with the idea to pave roads. It was basically my idea. Lawyers in Love. Basically my song. But like I said, I'm here to speak about Movie Geeks United, which is also my idea, but I've given it to these fellows, Jerry, Jamie, and Chris, to sort of run with it. No one was putting movie talk on the internet before I came up with it. And I said to these guys, just do it. See how it pans out. If it doesn't work, come back to me and I'll fix it. But this is their first show. So, give it a listen. Give them a try. Remember, I'm not going to be there for the whole thing. Obviously, if I was, it would be a huge success. And we'll see. Maybe that will happen. Perhaps I'll pop in again. But for now, enjoy the show and let these guys take you on a little ride. That was basically my idea.
Welcome to the premiere episode of Movie Geeks United, the greatest program in all movie talk radio history. Tonight, join your hosts, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry, as they discuss Grindhouse, the latest in movie headlines, a celebration of the worst of the worst in film with our topic of the week, movies that make us want to vomit, a special report from the Sarasota Film Festival featuring advance reviews of The Hawk is Dying, The Ten, and Exiles, and their must-see flick picks of the week. Pick up the phone now and become a part of internet radio history. The number to dial is 718-508-9477. And now, here's your favorite cinematic fanatics, your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
We are pumped. We are excited. This is the debut episode of Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie, and I am one of your co-hosts for the evening, but I am not alone. We have two additional co-hosts every week for the show. First up, highly opinionated, hysterically funny, but he knows movies inside and out. Say hello to Chris, everybody. Hey, Chris.
Hello, everybody. I'm very happy to be here.
And secondly, our other co-host, any reader of MySpace movie reviews knows him by name. He's one of the most prolific writers on the entire internet for movies, and he knows them backwards and forwards, an encyclopedic knowledge of film. Say hello to Jerry.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Thanks for spending your Sunday evening with us.
All right. How do you think the show's going so far, guys?
I think it's great.
Okay. I think
it's pretty good to me, yeah. Better Billy Freakin than Joe Esterhazy. That's all I have to say.
I think we can quit now while we're ahead, actually.
All right. It's been
with
fun.
With an opening like that. Actually, this week, it's a great week to start the show. First of all, I want to give out the number to our listeners out there. If you want to call in and put in your 2 cents, the number to dial is 718-508-9477. Or if you're too shy to speak on the radio, you can always drop us an email. We'll be checking it throughout the show at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. As I was saying, it's a perfect week to start the show because all the movie geeks out there have had a full week to digest what has to be the ultimate movie geek experience of the past few years. And, of course, I'm talking about Grindhouse. And it's a big movie, 3 hours and 15 minutes, for anyone out there that doesn't know. It's a celebration of kind of the drive-in theater exploitations or films that came out that were really prominent in the 70s more than any other time. And Robert Rodriguez directs the first half of the film, which is called Planet Terror. And it's kind of a gross-out zombie movie. The second half is Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, which is kind of a slasher cross between that and the race car movies of the 70s. It's a big experience. I'm sure all of our listeners out there have already seen it. But I wanted to approach it this way. If you were only able to watch one of those two movies again, which one would you choose? You have any idea about that, Jerry?
You are a cruel, cruel, cruel man. Very cruel. You're asking me to choose between possibly two of the best movies released in quite some time.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's the thing with Grindhouse, before I go. I mean, I said a lot last week in my appreciation of both films, and I have to tell you, here's the problem. Both films grow on you. At least for me, both films grow on me. And this is a constant problem with Rodriguez and Tarantino films. Sometimes they don't hit you right when you leave the theater. But give it a couple of days, and if you're like me, you usually have the soundtrack playing in the car. Both films grow on you. I have to say, if I really had to choose, I guess you're putting a gun to my head, right?
That's what you're doing there. Yeah.
I'm going to go with Death Proof. And okay. I'm even saying that, even knowing that the last half hour of Planet Terror may be the best climax in recent times in movies, I'm still going to go with Death Proof because since Reservoir Dogs, since the opening 5 minutes of Reservoir Dogs, I just, he's the man.
I'm just
going to have to go with that.
I think that I would go with Death Proof too, but have you been able to see it a second time yet?
No, I haven't because I have this addiction to going to see really bad movies every weekend. So I unfortunately haven't, and that's really bad on my part because Grindhouse, as everyone knows, is a sadly box office disappointment.
Yeah, and
much worse.
We do need to talk about that too.
Yeah.
But first off, I would choose the Tarantino version as well, even though I think that Rodriguez was the one out of the two. Rodriguez really stuck to the premise, the whole inspiration for the whole project, which was to make an exploitation flick in the style in which they were shown and made, 30 years ago. You know, he's very meticulous with the grain, with the scratches. He follows the aesthetic nature of the Grindhouse movies a lot more than Tarantino does. So he kind of follows their own set rules more than Tarantino. But at the same time, I think there's a lot more substance to kind of chew on in Tarantino's film that I would choose that one over Planet Terror. How about you, Chris?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's interesting. You guys both choose Death Proof, and Jerry made the point of saying that, you know, Tarantino's movies, they grow on you. Well, in this case, I'd have to say, yeah, sometimes they do grow on you. You know what else grows on you? Hemorrhoids.
I knew that was coming.
I'm sorry, and I love Tarantino too. I love everything he's done. You know, I mean, I even love Jackie Brown, and most people, you know, they don't hate Jackie Brown, but they say that's, you know, weak. I think it's really strong work from him. I think this is just sloppy, sloppy filmmaking, sloppy writing from him. And the more I think about the movie, actually, the more I'm disappointed, and the more I want Tarantino to become the, you know, the film god that everybody thought he was going to be. I don't see that he's doing that with his career. To me, it looks like he's just kind of gone down this path, which, you know, it was kind of this cartoonish thing that he's doing with his career, which he kind of started in Kill Bill, which it still worked because he still had, you know, that great dialogue in Kill Bill, but it doesn't work in this one. And I have to disagree with you, Jamie. I think, you know, and I've heard other people say that, you know, Rodriguez is the one that follows the rules. And actually, I don't think that's true. I think what Rodriguez is doing is paying homage, you know, to these grindhouse movies by taking all the good elements from them. You know, they had the sex and they had the zombies and the violence and the, you know, the crazy characters. He puts all that stuff. You know, grindhouse movies, they sucked. They weren't that good.
No, they weren't. No, they weren't. That's true.
He takes all the goodness and puts it in one movie. Tarantino is the one that truly made a grindhouse movie. He made a piece of shit. He made a boring movie. I mean, they talk endlessly about nothing. It's not Tarantino's style.
This is something that I will say, because you and I have discussed this, that it seems that as a writer, you know, when Tarantino first came out in, what was it, 92 with Reservoir Dogs?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Everybody was just taken by, above all things, his writing. I think his writing over the years has taken a back seat to his directing abilities. I think it's just like M. Night Shyamalan, Lady in the Water. Say what you will about the script. It's probably his weakest script, but it is his strongest directorial effort. And I think the same thing about Tarantino and Death Proof. I think he's growing leaps and bounds as a visual storyteller. But less and less his dialogue is less and less effective for me the more times that he comes out with a new film.
Yeah, I got to agree with you on that, you know, for this, for both the M. Night Shyamalan point and definitely Tarantino, you know, since we're talking about grindhouse here. It's true, it's just not, yeah, okay, he directed a car chase, and yeah, the car chase is pretty good. Is it one of the best car chases of all time? I don't know. Car chases all kind of seem the same to me. None of them really ever stand out. To me, personally, I thought it had some silly moments in it. You know, I mean, these roads, they go forever. Nobody's on them, you know. The beginning of the scene, his car's faster, and the girls can't get away from him. But towards the end of the scene, their car's faster, and he can't get away from them, you know. Like, it's just, and then, you know, all of a sudden there's jumps and, like, these perfect dunes for them to jump up and, you know, like, rocket into the sky like the bus from Speed. And it's just... just silliness. It's not worthy of the kind of filmmaker that he is to me.
Okay, let me ask a question, Chris. Let me ask you a question. If you had seen Death Proof on its own, let's say you hadn't had the 90 minutes there, if you had just seen Death Proof, do you think your opinion would change? Because this is actually a very important point to bring out, because I think people are so exhausted after Planet Terror that they don't want to sit through the long dialogue scenes.
I think that's a great point. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, it's not just Planet Terror either. You had those three awesome trailers in between. You know, which is a whole other experience on its own. You know, you want to see those movies.
I thought that every single trailer was dead on. I thought everyone was just fantastic.
Dead on in its own way. Each one was just, you know, like, I don't even think I have a favorite. I would want to see all three of those movies because they're all three of the previews so funny.
Yeah. We have a caller, guys.
Oh, all right, put them through.
Here we go. Our first caller from a 408 area code. You are on Movie Geeks United. Go ahead.
It's Will from HorrorYearbook.com.
Hey, what's up?
Hello. We were confused because you had us on hold when we listened to the show. We're talking shit on you, and then
Bring it on! Come on.
What do you got to say about Grindhouse, man?
I liked it. I don't think Grindhouse is a type of film like everyone's making it out to seem. It was just a place where they showed movies. So this whole what the film should be or things like that, I don't agree with. It was just it wasn't like the blanket movie chains you have now. It was just little theaters where they showed probably the same things that might be in these big Cineplexes nowadays, even. Yeah, just a few months late. They were like more maybe your second run or something like that.
Right.
I don't think it's a grindhouse type of film necessarily. I mean,
right.
I know they show like The Hills Have Eyes with, you know, like Rolling Thunder was the second feature for that film.
Right,
so,
the William Devane movie, right.
Yeah, that's a great, that's the film that started it all.
The
yeah.
second film that they normally showed was crap because it was just for the cheapskates that wanted two films for the price. So the whole
right,
moment.
But those are the movies that they're trying to pay homage to. Those are the movies that Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez will very readily tell you that they love. They love those movies, those bad movies.
Rolling Thunder being the one that Tarantino adores the most.
Yeah.
They have this production company after it.
Yeah, that's right.
There is something to be said, too, for spending $53 million to make to intentionally make an homage to bad movies.
67, to be precise.
I mean, that's his career is making a homage to, you know, bad films. So I think they're going to be better films than that, and that's where most people accuse him of ripping stuff off. It's just, I don't think it's a rip-off. It's just a bunch of...
It's not a rip-off.
Yeah.
And not at all, actually. There is the theory, and one of if you remember back after Pulp Fiction, four biographies came out on Tarantino. Very rare for a director that young and with only two films under his belt to be the subject of so many books.
Yeah, he's a phenomenon.
Yeah, and one of the books brought up a good point, is that there was one director who set the path for him to do this. There was one director. You know, because Tarantino does pay homage to, in Pulp Fiction supposedly, every scene is a homage to something else from another film. And there's one director, they say, that really set the way for Tarantino to do this, and that was De Palma, because De Palma paid homage constantly in his early
yes.
films to
yes.
Hitchcock. Every other scene is a homage to, like, Vertigo or Rear Window, and they have often said that it was someone like De Palma paved the way for someone like Tarantino.
No doubt.
Tarantino,
no doubt.
Tarantino is very open with his appreciation for De Palma, especially Blowout.
Oh,
he's
yes.
a big fan of Blowout, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's the scene in Kill Bill where the bride is in the, what's it called, the House of Blue Leaves or something
yes.
like that, you know, the showdown at the end. Well, when she first gets there, she goes, you know, there's this tracking shot on her while she's following Sophie Fatale.
Yeah.
You know, she follows her into the bathroom. I mean, that scene just, you know, like, I think he could very easily have said, hey, Brian De Palma, come shoot this scene for me. I mean, this scene just, like, very De Palma-esque scene, yeah. And he's open about it. He loves him. It's true.
Yeah.
You know what I think is special about Tarantino is he seems to know the difference, and for some people there is a difference, between movies and film.
Absolutely.
And he's very good at bringing out the most of both. In the same piece,
yeah.
you know, movies, just the kind of the trashy sensations of movies, just the feeling that kind of elates you. He knows that on a very basic level, and he also knows what makes a great film. You know, for the film critics or you know the film purists,
mm-hmm.
with camera work. And dialogue and character and the homages like we're discussing.
Yeah.
He really can combine both like no one else. Probably since Hitchcock or Spielberg, I see that in their work too.
Yes.
Tarantino really does that well.
Yeah, he does. And he
Grindhouse. I we missed part of the one of you didn't like Grindhouse. Who am I speaking to? I don't even know.
Well, this is Jamie, and then Chris is on the line, and Jerry's on the line.
I'm Jerry's on the line. Yes.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, what's up?
Who didn't like Grindhouse?
That's me. That's Chris. I'm not saying I didn't like it.
You know, he doesn't like the Tarantino one.
Yeah. I don't think that, you know, getting someone as talented as Tarantino and having him make a Grindhouse movie and truly make a Grindhouse movie where he doesn't bring his Tarantino-style dialogue. You know, some people are saying that the dialogue in this movie is, oh, it's that classic Tarantino dialogue. Well, I don't think it is. These characters, they talk on and on about nothing. And they're annoying, obnoxious.
Okay, there's that one scene where the three girls are talking, and it was just to set up that one thing about that girl falling and her being cat-like.
Yes.
Right.
was on the roof of the car, you would know she was going to, you know, survive that, which was absolutely ridiculous, I thought. I don't know why we sat through that whole camera spinning.
You brought up a good point.
And, you know, them talking just to let us know that she, so when she got on the roof of the car, you know, sort of, you know, the hood, she wouldn't slip off or she would survive. And it was a little, like you threw that whole, that was just ridiculous and too much for that. I do agree with that.
Yeah. You and Chris bring up a very good point, and this reminds me when we went to go see Pulp Fiction when it first came out. I remember, if you know the scene leading up to where they're in the apartment, Jules and Vince are in the apartment, and it's, you know, it goes through a very long, there's a very long exchange of dialogue. And I just remember the kid in back of me saying, you know, obviously it was like me, a Tarantino fan, where is he going with this? Why is it taking so long? And he does have these things where he loves the sound of his dialogue.
Yeah.
And yeah, I will give, Chris, I will give you that, that, yeah, this, the, that, there are, that you could probably cut out maybe 10 minutes of dialogue in Death Proof.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, that, was, that scene was, that's the only problem I actually had with Death Proof. It was just, like, Quentin Tarantino, that, like, seemed like he needed one more dialogue scene.
Right.
And just threw that in there, and the whole time I was watching that, once you got, once you figured it out, you've seen enough movies, you knew what it was leading up to.
Yeah.
And so it, that, I remember that was the only problem I had with it, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole thing.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
The whole,
as an experience, as an experience, it's a good time, but, you know, ultimately, it is like a grindhouse movie. It's very boring, and all they got is the car chase. So, you
yeah.
know, you get a director like Tarantino to make a movie like that, that's like getting... that's like getting Rachel Ray over to your house. She's going to cook you dinner, and you ask her to make Jell-O, you know?
Well, wait, wait, whoa, 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 whoa. You just compare Tarantino to Rachel Ray?
I'm just saying.
Wait,
you know,
wait, no, no, Rachel Ray? We'd be lucky if she could make Jell-O. Come on, Rachel. Oh, my God,
okay.
Chris.
Okay,
I'm
Emerald.
About it.
Emerald, then, Emerald.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you. Okay, I'll go with that. Okay.
That
all right.
Thanks for calling in, man, all right?
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Support you guys, and I'll listen in every week.
Bye-bye, man.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we got one more caller, and then we're going to get to movie news. Hopefully, this caller has something to say about Grindhouse 2.
Okay.
817 area code, you are on. Hello.
Hi, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller. This is John from the Dead Air Show.
Hey,
what's
up,
boys? How you doing, man?
Doing great. How have you guys been?
Great, great.
Show's going fantastic, man. I'm really glad to see you guys finally on here.
Thank you. We owe it to you.
Oh, please, you don't owe me crap.
Yeah, we owe it to you. We do.
Nah. You guys would have found out the means to get on here eventually. We just were really impressed with Jamie and then Jerry, you know, and so forth, and the blogs and everything. So it's a natural progression for you guys, and it's going to be huge. But
enjoy all your support.
Yes,
we really do.
We do.
Oh,
we really do.
I understand you have a special guest on your show tonight.
Yeah, actually, we do. Tonight we have comedian Ari Shaffir. He's well known in the L.A. comedy circuit. Not too popular, mainstream, but one of the main things that I don't know if you guys heard about, I'll just touch on this real quick because you got a show to do, but you heard about Carlos Mencia, and not that many people realize that there's a big thing right now that Joe Rogan, the host of Fear Factor, who's also a very, very funny comedian, has called Mencia out for stealing his material.
Mm.
And recently, in a wave of internet things, and like YouTube, you'll find a lot of, just Google Ari Shaffir and like Joe Rogan confronting, and you'll see how a lot of this material was stolen by Carlos Mencia. And Ari is a Jewish comedian, very controversial. There's a lot of racial material, and he's going to come on tonight. We're going to, you know, go over some of that and discuss the whole Don Imus thing.
No.
I didn't get a chance to catch Chris, though. I need to see that, but from hearing what you guys are talking about, I take you guys are the experts, so I'll see what happens whenever I check it out.
I hope you
definitely
get to see it,
to see it and give us a call and let us know what you think about it once you do.
Most definitely. Well, we're on right after you guys at 6 o'clock Central, deadairshow.com, so good luck. You guys are doing great.
Thank you.
I will talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, buddy. Thank you.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
You too. Okay. So it's time for movie news, where we'll review some of the latest movie headlines. And sifting through the big news for the past couple of weeks, I think we all can agree that no matter what we think about the Tarantino film, a high point of the whole experience was Kurt Russell.
Are we all in agreement on that? Yeah. And for me, a priceless moment in that in Death Proof was when right before Kurt Russell gets into his car to claim his first victim, he looks up at the camera and he just shines like a perfect movie star smile, like right at the camera.
Yes.
And you just start cheering. You're like, yeah, man, that guy's a badass movie star right there. And one of his best loved roles is being tinkered with in a planned remake of Escape from New York. Gerard Butler from 300 is slated to play Snake Plissken in the remake. And this you know, it's just another in a long line of remakes where you kind of scratch your head and say, why bother? Why are you doing that? And another one that just came out last week in the news, Rod Laurie, who is the writer-director of The Contender, he's a very good writer. He's planning to remake Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. And I just want to get a consensus between us. How do we feel about this, the remakes in general of pretty well-loved films? These aren't obscure films. These are really respected by film lovers everywhere.
Right. I think we should let Chris or you go first. I have a lot to say on this, but I'd like to hear what you guys have to say.
Well,
I'll jump in here. You know, frankly, I don't think, you know, you can come up with examples of remakes that are pretty good movies. You know, you
absolutely
can come up with an example of, like, you know, say, Cape Fear. That's a good remake. And frankly, I think that the Scorsese version is better than the original. The original is just kind of a throwaway, campy. I think it was 50s it was made. I don't know the year, but, you know, it's pretty good. Not great. Not a beloved movie. The Fly is a remake of, you know, of an old campy horror movie. The remake's better. But I don't think you can point to any, that I can think of, any remakes of a loved movie that turned out, you know, that turned out well. You know,
yeah.
I can't think of one example.
And honestly, do you think it has to be, they say that the sequel, the remake to Escape from New York is less of a remake and more kind of a prequel to tell you where Snake Plissken came from prior to the events of Carpenter's film?
I hate prequels.
Yeah.
I think Lucas proved to us that maybe prequels are better left as just backstory.
Right.
And I'm saying this as someone who saw each of those films a number of times, but I can say in hindsight, you know, my brother said this best about prequels. And, you know, we don't have a prequel to Lawrence of Arabia because we don't need to see him getting kicked out of boarding school. I don't need to see Rick from Casablanca, you know, running guns to Ethiopia. I didn't need to see Anakin have a tizzy fit in his Dawson Creek years. I think the idea of remakes goes back to something that David Lean said in his acceptance speech for the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award, is that the guys in the money department can take some risk. They really can take some risk. We don't need to see remake after remake after remake. And
but
I mean,
they don't do it.
And no, they don't do it.
You see that with the sequels too. Every week there's an announcement that there's going to be, you know, three or four new sequels up and coming. You know, and some of them you get excited about. Indiana Jones 4.
Yeah, that. Or Spider-Man. You know, Spider-Man even you get excited about. But
Spider-Man, yeah. But there's so many that, you know, just they're beating a dead horse. They're getting as much money as they can. They're draining the concept to get as much money as they can.
Absolutely.
And they just kill the original spark of inspiration that made the original so successful.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's true. That is true. But then a lot of the movies that, you know, you see sequels to, you know, you want to make a Pirates of the Caribbean 3, 4, 5, 6.
There'll probably be
really
20 in our lifetime.
Make 20 of them. I don't give a shit. You know what? I'll say it. The first one's not that great. You know, it's not. Make as many as you want. You know, Spider-Man, I understand. It's a comic book movie. The comic book's been going for, what, 40 years now? Something
yeah.
like that. You know, there's plenty of stories to be told there. But then, you know, with movies, you know, like Escape from New York, you know, you don't really need a sequel to that. You don't really need to do anything else. Leave it alone. Come up with an original idea and make it, you know, get another movie where Gerard Butler can take his shirt off, you know, like, there's got to be something else, you know, like, why do you need to do it, you know.
Well, are either of you guys in love with the original Straw Dogs, the Peckinpah version?
For years, I would say that was my favorite Dustin Hoffman film, but let me say this about,
I feel sorry for the director who thinks that they can come in and do a better job than Peckinpah. Peckinpah couldn't even do a better job than himself. His last two movies are travesties, Convoy and The Osterman Weekend. I mean, he's done so much coke during those movies, and especially doing Convoy with Kris Kristofferson. I mean, he's just The Walking Dead at that point. Mm-hmm. But I feel sorry for anyone who thinks they could one-up Peckinpah. Not even Tarantino could do that. Not even John Woo could do that.
No.
Rod Laurie is a very kind of, from what I've seen of his work so far, he's a very intelligent, thoughtful writer. But his movies, or at least The Contender, which I've seen, it has a lot going on for it, but it feels more comfortable kind of on a television, like you're watching an episode of The West Wing.
Well,
you know, it's that kind of material. I don't know if he can cinematically mine anything from Straw Dogs that Peckinpah didn't bring to the table 30 years ago.
Yeah, and it's good that you bring up a TV, because he created that show with Gina Davis on where she's the president, Commander-in-Chief.
Commander-in-Chief, right.
And that, you know, that's, I mean, you bring up a good point about his movies. They are, his first movie, actually, Deterrence, is actually very good, but it's something you could watch on the small screen.
Yeah.
The Contender's more showcase for Joan Allen than anything else, and the film after that, The Last Castle with Robert Redford,
exactly,
is, I don't know what to make of that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it is a little different.
It was fairly forgettable, you know, I mean, it was Robert Redford in a Robert Redford kind of role.
It was Robert Redford's comeback year, as I remember.
Right.
Yeah, and you do get to see his 70-year-old boobs in the movie. So, The Last Castle's there.
Yeah.
But another big thing of the news, and I know that I'm not a huge fan of martial art flicks, but it's a big kind of thing that people are getting excited about, is Jet Li and Jackie Chan are finally pairing together for a film, and it's called The Forbidden Kingdom. But I'm very disappointed in this, because it should be the heat of martial art movies. You know, when Pacino and De Niro, like, butted heads in roles that they're iconically known for, it should be that kind of project. But as it turns out, this isn't going to be the badass martial arts movie that everybody's hoping for. It's actually kind of like a kid's movie, it looks like. The Forbidden Kingdom.
Well, you know, both of those guys are kind of trying to get away from, you know, the martial arts movie, aren't they? I mean, didn't Jet Li say after his last one he's not doing it anymore?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I don't even remember the last time Jackie Chan did something that didn't have, you know, the funny guy, sidekick.
Yeah.
I don't think he's making, you know, Rumble in the Bronx anymore, those kind
of things. No, and I didn't even know really what the details of this movie were until Jamie told me earlier about it, and I will say this. This film is a travesty already. It's directed by the same guy who did The Haunted Mansion. So I really have to honestly say that if this film was to stop production tomorrow, we would all be better off.
Yeah.
This is unfortunately not the heat of martial art epics.
Yeah, I can't say even if it was. I'm kind of like Jamie. I'm not the biggest martial arts fan. You know, I mean, when it's done well by a good director, when it's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Absolutely.
When it's Kill Bill.
Yeah.
You know, those are the examples that come to my mind. I'm not nuts about, you know, those martial arts movies, they're a lot like grindhouse pictures. You know, they're real low budget. They're not the best crafted pieces of artwork. You know, if you're into martial arts, if you, you know, are personally, you know, into the martial arts, you probably enjoy them because good moves and stuff. And, oh, look, he hit him with a ladder and then took a bite out of a popsicle at the same time or whatever. You know, well, that's amazing. But, you know, as you know, someone who likes to see some intelligent cinema, I don't think there's much there, really.
No, not at all.
Yeah, but it's like going back to what we were saying with Grindhouse. It's the cheap pleasures of just seeing these two titans of the martial art film world come together and kick ass, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's just if you pair these two together, that's what you want to get.
Yeah.
So this project, as it reads, I'll read the plot synopsis right now. A discovery made by a kung fu obsessed American teen sends him on an adventure to China, where he joins up with a band of martial arts warriors in order to free the imprisoned Monkey King. And did you guys talk about, I was having phone difficulty, did you guys talk about what this Rob Minkoff has directed up until now?
Yeah, The Haunted Mansion was one of them. And
Stuart Little, 1 and 2, The Lion King. This isn't the first person you think of to direct a big martial arts throwdown.
It makes you want to see The Golden Child again. I mean, that's saying something. I mean, this film has hemorrhage written all over it. I mean,
yeah. Well, speaking of Asian kind of action cinema, I just got back from the first weekend of the Sarasota Film Festival.
Oh yeah.
And I was able to see. There's a discrepancy here on how you pronounce his last name, but Johnny Two, Johnny Toe, Johnny Tao, however you pronounce it. All due respect, we're going with all three just to be safe.
Good choice.
I watched his latest movie, which is called Exiled, and it's about a kind of a band of assassins that are double-crossed, and a big crime lord is on their tail as they're on the run. And I tell you what, we saw three movies yesterday during the festival, and that was the one that really blew me away. And I don't know his work. Jerry, you're a lot more familiar with his work than I am. What are some of the other movies that he's done?
The first one I remember watching is The Heroic Trio, which is Michelle Yeoh, I think Maggie Cheung, and I forget who else. You know, forgive me, it's been, 10, 15 years since I've seen it. The others are Full-Time Killer, Running Out of Time, Election, Throwdown, and The Mission, which The Mission was another one that I saw. And they're... I would have to honestly say, of anyone working in the business, I think he's the rightful heir to John Woo or Ringo Lam or Soy Hark or any of those guys.
Yeah, he is the one most closely associated with John Woo. That's true, from what I've read. And he doesn't have he isn't as focused on the kind of ballet type action in his action sequences than Woo is. But he's very good at staging, at camera movement. So that you can see every punch, every frame of action, and that's a big. I'm a big stickler about this because every action movie that comes out, the camera's so overhyped and shaking and cut so many times that you can't focus on what's happening. You can't see anything.
You feel like you're getting punched in the face when you're watching.
And it makes you sick. But this it's beautiful, beautifully staged. Great performers, great faces in his films. And I really enjoy The Exiled. I did not, however, feel as strongly about the other two movies I saw, which were The Ten, which is from writer-director David Wayne. It's kind of an ensemble comedy. It comes out in theaters on August 3rd. I thought that I would really like this one, but it plays kind of like Kentucky Fried Movie or Amazon Woman on the Moon. A very kind of odd, unexpected tone, and it's 10 different short films based on the Ten Commandments, and only two of them really work. The rest kind of fall flat, and the two that work, there's one with Liev Schreiber, where he has neighbor envy, and he sees that his neighbor has bought a new CAT scan machine, and Liev Schreiber says to his family, damn him, I got to buy my own now. And so eventually he's buying like 20 CAT scan machines that overtake his house, and his family leaves him, and he's crumbled and crushed. It works as a humorous kind of 10-minute short. And the other one that works is Winona Ryder falls in love with a ventriloquist dummy. And actually, believe it or not, Winona Ryder is the high point of this movie. She's very good. But, you know, she starts a love affair with this dummy. But at the same time, it just reminded me of an inferior version of the Gene Wilder segment of Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex, the one where he falls in love with a sheep. That's classic. And this one's kind of much inferior, but it's still a high point of the movie that I expected so much more from. I didn't see Wet Hot American Summer. That is David Wayne's first film, I believe.
Yes,
that's what I was going to say. Yeah, and he was a member of the MTV show The State, and he's a member of Stella, the troupe Stella, which is he, Michael Showalter, and Michael Ian Black. And they're all real funny guys, just so funny. And I personally like Wet Hot American Summer.
Totally.
I think it kind of grows on you. It's got a weird. I think I know what you're talking about the comedy, the wacky comedy that you're referring to. And Wet Hot American Summer is a lot like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a very kind of thin line. It's a very thin line to tread between funny and unfunny when you try to go really silly comedy,
mm-hmm.
where either you're laughing out loud or you're just groaning. And
right.
The 10 is a groaner of a movie, really. But it's still not as disappointing as the other movie I saw, which is The Hawk is Dying.
Uh-oh.
It was shot in Gainesville, which is very close to where Chris and I live. And it's the movie that Paul Giamatti did after he shot Sideways.
Mm.
So Paul Giamatti is a really kind of hot actor after Sideways comes out, and he chooses The Hawk is Dying as his follow-up. And it's easy to see why, because the high point of the movie is Giamatti, and he really surprised me. He has several incredibly emotional moments, and he has these long monologues that fill pages that he does wonders with. But as for the movie itself, I think it's going for a hypnotic tone, but it's another fine line. When you try to go hypnotic, you can easily fall into sleepy. and the movie, the hawk may be dying, but the audience is definitely sleeping because this movie was just dead dull.
Mm.
And I'm not sure when that comes out, but and plus he shot the movie in Gainesville, which is it's a creative decision, and he brings out the best in Gainesville. But the only problem is Gainesville isn't an incredibly cinematic action to shoot your movie in.
I was about to say, the best in Gainesville, isn't that great, actually?
Yeah, you're just, look how he captured the trees. Wow, that's great. We got a caller on an 863 area code. I'm going to patch him in right now.
Okay, excellent.
863 area code, go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, who's this?
This is Ty.
Hey, Ty. Hey, what's up?
Jamie, Chris, Jerry, what's up?
How you doing?
What's up, man?
How you doing?
Good. I just want to get back to something you guys were talking about earlier, which is Rob Lurie.
Mm-hmm.
One of his first movies, I don't know if you guys saw it, it was called Deterrence.
Yes, I mentioned that. I didn't.
I must have tuned in just after you guys were talking about that, but I thought that movie was awesome. I was blown away by that movie.
It was his best film, I think, the best thing he's directed. And
what was that movie about? What was it?
He was the president of the United States.
Kevin Pollak is the president, right?
Yeah, Kevin Pollak. And there's like a nuclear war. There's going to be nuclear war. And the only man who has the key, he has it in a briefcase, and it's handcuffed to his arm. And
yes.
Do you remember?
Is the play comical?
No. It's not comic. It's not... It takes place in a diner in the Midwest, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And it's very intense.
Kevin Pollak is the president,
yes.
And it's not a comedy?
No, it's not. I know. You got to spend your disbelief there. It's not, yes, it's not funny, but it's a surprisingly good debut.
Yeah.
Really are blown away by what he can do with, it's basically takes place in this diner. It's almost like watching a play.
Exactly. That was my next point, was it almost was like a stage play. It could have been, because the whole movie was in that diner.
Yes.
They never went outside the diner. So that was just my point, that movie was awesome. And,
all right, buddy. All right.
Your show is great. Keep
point,
up the good
though.
Work.
Thanks for calling in, man. I really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Bye. See you later.
Bye-bye. Okay, one more caller, and then we're going to get to our topic of the week because time is running down.
Okay.
This is a caller from our 214 area code. 214, go ahead.
Hi, it's Alex from the Dead Air Show.
Oh, cool.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
It's going good.
How you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm listening to the show. It sounds really, really good.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks so much.
I wanted to chime in, actually, on something you guys were talking about a little while ago, about the fight sequences.
Yes.
I think the biggest, I don't want to say victim. the movie that is really bad about that jittery fighting style was the Bourne movies.
Yes.
Ooh, which one? Now, which one are you talking about?
Well, the first one wasn't so bad.
No,
the second one looked like Michael J. Fox was filming it.
Okay. There's a very important reason. The most of that was shot handheld because of Paul Greengrass, and he's a very big, like Soderbergh, a very big handheld actor.
Yeah.
So that's a very good point.
I can't disagree with that.
It was shaky.
I know it was all handheld, but honestly, I remember walking out of that movie too, feeling a little queasy out of Supremacy. Not so much Bourne Identity. It might have been handheld, but it felt like it was filmed like footheld or something.
Yeah. Well, if I remember right, okay, because Doug Liman directed the first Bourne movie,
right?
And then he goes on to do Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
That's right.
But the guy that you were just talking about, I think he was the director of photography on the first one, and then he went on to become the actual director of the second one.
Well, he,
Greengrass.
Yeah, he did the United 93, but before Bourne Supremacy, he did a movie on Bloody Sunday.
Right.
A very documentary-style film.
Right.
And he's, I think he's doing also the Bourne Ultimatum, so I guess you might want to not drink anything before you see the film.
But I think that United 93 is a prime example of how handheld camera work can work in your favor, because it really lends United 93 an intimacy that it really needs. I'm stunned by United 93. It was my favorite movie last year, and Paul Greengrass, he's on the map for me with that one. I'll watch anything he comes out with after that.
Yeah, I think it worked really well in that movie, but I think in Bourne Supremacy, it got to the point where it was so jittery you could not see the action at all. That whole fight in the apartment, and you could tell that these actors spent a lot of time choreographing the fights and doing a lot of training, and it was all for naught because you can't see a damn move in the entire fight.
Right.
Exactly, and that's the good stuff. That's the stuff that you want to be able to enjoy and watch. You know.
Yeah.
But thanks so much for calling.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much.
We look forward to your show tonight.
All right, thanks a lot, guys.
So our topic of the week, we've spent a long time going over all these other topics. Let's talk movies that make us want to vomit, because I know that a lot of people are really excited about this topic. And I know we have all of our own ideas about what are some of the worst of the worst movies. And there are different categories of bad movies, if you guys agree with me here. There's
absolutely
movies that can be enjoyed as camp.
Right.
You know, and you get some enjoyment out of those. Those can't necessarily be classified as the worst of the worst. And then there are some that are just so low budget and cheaply done, but you kind of forgive them that because it's like a pet project or a labor of love, and you know it's not of a level to be classified as an epic worst of the worst movie. But what are some of your movies that make you want to vomit? I know Jerry, you have some ideas on that.
I have some ideas, but I'm going to let everyone go before me. Because you guys have I know what both of yours are, so you guys have much better than I. I'm going to let you guys go right now.
All right. Chris, how about you, man?
All right. Well, for me, the worst, it's not so much any one movie, but the kind of movies that make me want to vomit are the romantic comedy. And it's not that I have anything against romance. It's not even that I have anything against romantic comedies. I love a good romantic comedy, I have a girlfriend, she likes romantic comedies, so, as a result, I have to see a fucking lot of them. I get to see all of them. But the problem I have is they all kind of follow this same, storyline. I don't think there's any genre, whether it's, horror or, suspense, or action. Of all those genres, I think that romantic comedies, there's no other genre that's more like a coloring book than romantic comedy. It's not even like a coloring book, really. Like, a coloring book, that's kind of an insult to coloring books, because romantic comedy is more like those paint, water paint books that you used to do when you were a kid, where, the colors are already, on the page, and you just have to dip the brush in the water and splotch it on the page and the colors come out, They follow the same, the meet cute, and then everything's good for a while, and then about three-fourths of the way through the movie, there's some sort of trouble, and how are they going to get out of this? And, they did, and they live happily ever after, and
it's all major paint by numbers, and
absolutely.
I kind of agree with you, because my movies that make me want to vomit are closely related. But it isn't a particular movie. It's an actress. And that actress is Meg Ryan. She can't just be in front of a camera. She has to exude cuteness, you know? Like, it's coming out of every pore of her body, and it's such an attempt. I mean, you can see the effort going in it, you know? And she just makes me sick. Every movie I see, especially French Kiss, I mean, she just makes me want to vomit. And have you seen her lately?
Yeah, she's in a movie this week.
Yes. Whatever plastic surgery she's doing with her lips, she looks like the fucking Joker. And, you know, it just makes it worse.
Her smile does start behind the ears, it's true.
Yes.
We're getting sued.
So basically anything, especially anything kind of after When Harry Met Sally, romantic comedy-wise, I just don't like.
Well, it's like they're all trying to be either, it's like the two templates for romantic comedies are either When Harry Met Sally or Pretty Woman, which came out, you know, generally in the same sort of period. And then
right.
in the 20 years or so since When Harry Met Sally, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on of all the ones that are just exactly the same thing. And it's not just bad actors. You know, I mean, good actors get caught up in doing them, too. You know, like that Laws of Attraction had Pierce Brosnan and Julianne Moore. That was a
terrible movie.
It's the same crap. Like, I don't understand why these good actors. Another one is Must Love Dogs. You know, you got John Cusack and Diane Lane, two fantastic actors. And for some reason, they thought that this turd was going to fly.
We've gone from the comedy of manners to romantic comedies, and we've lost a lot of the witty spark of, like, Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and we've gone to, you know, movies, you know, that really are so formulaic, it's disgusting.
Right.
Yeah. That's just, Jerry, what would be your movie?
Well,
you want?
I thought long and hard about this. I was going to pick a theme, but I just decided to go with a movie, and I decided to pick the Omen remake.
Oh.
Because I think it is a very insulting movie, a movie that was made for one reason only, to capitalize on the release date of 666. It would have been a lot cheaper to have cleaned up a print of the original film and re-released it. Or, you know, of course, there was a DVD made of it, a new DVD made, but I would say, why waste the film? Because you're watching the movie, and the director, Jonathan Moore, who seems to specialize in remakes like Flight of the Phoenix and so forth, I'm sure he had the movie on while they were filming and told his actors, just watch what Gregory Peck does, just watch what Lee Remick does, just watch what Peck, you know, you're not giving any sort of stage direction, but the film is heinously unoriginal, and speaking of paint by numbers, you couldn't get more paint by numbers. It is
That's
a scene
right.
to scene remake. First of all, the Jerry Goldsmith music is gone, so that's a big thing working against it.
Which was so memorable.
Oh, it was very memorable. Look, the film, even I'm not a big fan of the third one, this one redeems the third film within the first 2 minutes. But the film doesn't bother to update itself, and that's something I find very troubling.
It has no reason for being.
And it has so much reason for being if someone had actually tried to do something with it. I mean, you were living in the times of, how should we say it, rapture culture, if you want to use that phrase, but you're also, the film commits a couple of, commits one big mistake, and it's a mistake that the original films don't. The little boy, Damien, does not really know who he is until halfway through the second film when Lance Henderson
right.
tells him, yeah, you're the Antichrist, when he's in military school. Here, there's a horrible error that the boy knows who he is. He knows he's evil, and it ruins the film. And
yeah.
there's been much made about the casting. I know a lot of people like Liv Scribner. I think that when people said he was as... like Gregory Peck, if I was Gregory Peck, I'd get out of my grave and punch him. Julia Stiles is no Lee Remick. I think, personally, she's too young for the part. And then there's Mia Farrow, who I'm sure someone in 20th Century Fox thought, hey, let's get the original Devil's Mother, Rosemary's Baby, to replay the Billy Whitlaw part. And you're watching Mia Farrow, you know, play this part, and you realize that being married to the chairman of the board and the ultimate nebbish has taken a toll on her. I mean, you really just, you know, going from Frank to Woody has done a number on this woman, and maybe she should just stay off screen. But this film, I mean,
I even think the Planet of the Apes remake has more reason to exist than this.
Ooh, oh my god! Bold statement.
And I hate that film with a passion too. So.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, let's you sold your pick very well, Jerry.
Thank you.
Let's try to go to an 863 area code. We have a caller on hold here. Let me see if I can unmute them. 863, go ahead.
Yes, William Friedkin here. Earlier made reference to the fact that Lawyers in Love was my idea. Actually, it was Running on Empty. Yes, Running on Empty was my idea, based in whole on a life experience that was solely mine. But actually, enough about me. Back to the show. We just wanted to clarify that, because prior to this, there had not been a clarification on the Running with Empty, Running on Empty. Lawyers in Love, beautiful song, not my idea.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Billy.
Thank you.
Keep up the good...
I just hung up on him.
Oh,
I think.
We're going to get sued. That's okay. Audiences around the country have hung up on Friedkin many times.
They've been doing it for years.
And we got a caller at a 954 area code. Let me unmute them. You are unmuted. Go ahead. What's a movie that makes you want to vomit?
Hey, guys, it's Steve from Movie Battle Royale.
Awesome. Thank you for the bulletin, by the way, earlier. Thank you very much for all you've done.
Hey, no problem. This is I'm enjoying the show so far. I know you only got a couple of minutes left. I took this a little bit more literally about the films that make you want to vomit.
Oh, my God, you didn't vomit, did you?
Well, I've seen a lot of movies, and there was only one time where I almost got sick. And I don't know if you guys have ever had that experience before, but at the end of Pink Flamingos, I just couldn't do it. I had to look away, and it almost came up, you know?
I'm with you there 100%.
Yeah, and that doesn't happen ever. So.
Well, I think that's one situation where, you know, the director of the movie would actually be pleased to hear that. I think
yeah.
that would bring a big smile to John Waters' face. And
John Waters intended for me to throw up that night, but he didn't do it. And one more thing.
Yeah,
but another movie that kind of did that, but in a different way, and you guys kind of brought it up earlier, was the shaky cam stuff. That gets to me, too, in theater and... Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, that does it all the time.
That one's good on TV, but in the theater, couldn't do it.
I heard
yeah,
about
I
that.
Yeah, I find that if you watch the film and you're seated like a mile away from the screen, it won't make you sick.
Oh.
So.
Well, first, speaking of films that literally make you nauseous, you're not going to believe this, but the Spy Kids in 3D made me nauseous.
Yeah, but it's
I had to walk
that
out.
Great on that one.
Was that the 3D or was
yeah,
it
the 3D.
Yeah.
I had to, and I saw it in a theater that really doesn't have the technology for 3D.
Right.
Yeah, it's debatable whether it was in 3D or they are having problems. It's just a miracle if they can get the film in focus 9 times out of 10. but yeah, I actually that's the one time I actually felt nauseous recently during the film.
Oh god.
All right. Well, thanks for putting on this great show.
Hey, no problem.
Hey,
thank you for
thank
all
you
that you've
so
done.
Much.
All right. Cool.
Thank you, man. Bye bye now.
Bye bye.
Okay, one more caller. 410 area code has 1 minute.
Okay. Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
You guys did a good job. This is Lon from Maryland. I know Jerry. I tell you, I'm not going to really say it's a movie that made me vomit, but the only movie ever made me fall asleep was Hudson Hawk. That was probably the worst movie ever made. So. and I literally did fall asleep in a theater. So, hey, it was a great show.
Thank you,
Bob. Keep up doing work, and I will continue listening to you.
Thank you very much.
You know what? I hate to say it, but I actually really like Hudson Hawk.
I knew you were going to say that.
I hate that you've
I
done
really
it
do. I liked it when it first came out. I thought, what a clever idea. You know, they're timing their heist with a standard song. You know, they know they have – it's cheesy, but I thought it worked.
It's better than Perfect Stranger, I'll give you that.
I can understand that just from the previews. And you and Chris actually share a disdain for Giovanni Ribisi. And
I really do.
Yeah, you know, he's got the acting talent of a roof shingle, basically. You know, I mean, every time it's the same performance. You know, you want
thank you.
You want the weirdo, little chubby guy that brings a little mystery to the role and overacts it every time? You go get Giovanni Ribisi. It's just boring every time out. He's never seen a reason that he should be making movies.
And let me tell you something. Perfect Stranger is everything that you just described.
Chris, we got a minute left, and I got to cover what's coming up in the next show. But can you do a little Giovanni Ribisi in Boiler Room?
Oh, sure, sure. That's the scene where he's talking to his dad. He's talking about his leg. His leg injury.
Yes.
He says,
"Just my leg. My leg was broken. Dad, I'm sorry."
He sounds like Jerry Lewis, does he?
He sure does. It does. Horrible.
All right, we want to thank everyone for listening in. Next week we're going to have a ton more topics. I think we're very close to finalizing a very special guest, so you guys won't want to miss that. I believe that we're going to cover about 18 additional films I'll be watching at Sarasota Film Festival and possibly talking political films. But catch us midweek to find out for sure, and we'll have that information up on our blogs. Special thanks to our engineer, Dave Stimson, of Bit by Bit Studios in Winter Haven in Lakeland, Florida, and our beautiful and talented announcer, Tiffany Littleton. Thanks, guys.
Hey, it was fun, man. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
All right, man. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye.